the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler, and our special subject today is going to be Rob Bernard talking about executive compensation strategies. But you do know, it's that time of year again. We always say that, no matter what time of year it is, we always say, oh, it's that time of year. Well, it is. April 15th, taxes will be on the minds of most Americans. Since we discuss quite actively here and focus particularly on retirement, and the best way to save for retirement is using a pension plan. When you're talking about tax planning and retirement, you get a tax deduction for contributions to it. The earnings are tax deferred. It's a great way to save for retirements. And so, Jim, why don't we begin with changes in some of these laws that are affecting the various tax plans?
Well, I think, John, the good news for 2015 is that contribution limits across most pension plans are going up. Most plans that we look at, you know, are going to see increases this year. So what does that mean? It means you can put more money, could be socked away for your retirement, which means if you can afford to save, you can put more money into a tax-deferred plan, which means you're going to save in taxes. So more tax savings and more contributions that you can put away and have that money compound for you growing for your retirement plan. So, John, that's always good news in an era that we live in that they're always looking at ways to raise taxes. Well, here's one way that can lower your taxes.
I don't know. Having watched the State of the Union address last week, I can't imagine the president giving more tax deductions. What brought about these changes? I mean, are they automatic? Have they been built in? What about inflation adjustments? Maybe the greater the contributions limits, greater tax savings for individuals when you combine these.
Well, I think many of these increases are COLA-based. They're scheduled to increase over time with inflation. And here's the good news. The good news is that the limits are going up. With the exception of the president, both parties want to save more. I mean, the president wants to limit the plans, which we talked about in the last segment. But, you know, both parties realize that we have a retirement crisis ahead. The largest retirement population in the history of this country is moving into retirement in the next 10 years. So that's going to not only put a strain on government resources and things like Social Security and Medicare. So you do have politicians, the government wants individuals to save for their retirement, which means they're going to be less dependent on government. And that's why these plans were put into place. They wanted to create an incentive to get you to save. In other words, hey, we're the government. We're going to give you an incentive, a tax deduction, if you do this. So outside the president's tax increases, those contributions are going to save you more in taxes. So the incentives are worth more to you today in tax savings because the top federal tax bracket, if you are in the Obama tax bracket, is 44%. Or if you live in a state like I do in California, where the top tax rate is 13.3, you're talking about over 57% marginal tax rate. So in effect, for those of you that are putting away money in a 401k, a SEP IRA plan, a defined contribution, defined benefit plan, you could be saving up to half of your contribution is being paid for with basically government tax savings.
Well, not to mention the savings, but also the benefits of an employer matching your contributions. Many employers today have 401k programs. They have matching contributions to that. So not only do you save on the taxes, but also the benefit of matching contributions. So for the most part, it's a win-win for the savers and for the investors. Why don't we run through the changes for 2015? They're usually sort of labyrinthine if you're not watching it as a professional and people wonder what's going on. Let's look at that.
Well, let's go through probably the most popular plans first and talk about the increase in limits. And let's start with probably the most popular plan out there. The 401k plan is increased by $500. It goes from $17,500 to $18,000. So that's an increase of $500. If you are a government employee, the 457 plan likewise goes from $17,500 to $18,000. And same thing with 403b plans. And also the catch-up provision. Once you turn age 50, there's a catch-up provision, and that goes from $5,500 to $6,000. So if you're 50 and over, you just got a $1,000 increase in the amount that you can salt away in a 401k program, 403b plan, and a 457 plan. Defined benefit plans are frozen to fund for a $210,000 contribution at retirement. Defined contribution plans, which includes everything from SEPs to money purchase plans to profit sharing, they increase from $52,000 to $53,000, so a $1,000 increase there. Annual compensation limits on which the percentages are based on, that increased from $260,000 to $265,000, so another increase there. Individual retirement accounts, IRAs, there was actually no change. They're limited to around $5,500. And individual retirement accounts above age 50 are still no change there. They're at $6,500. If you're age 50 and over, you can put $6,500 away into an IRA plan. That's interesting because that one of the President's State of the Union proposals would force employers to have a payroll deduction plan if they had 10 or more employees into these IRA programs. So that could be up to $5,500 taken out of your check or $65,000 depending on age. Simple IRA retirement accounts have gone up by $500. They go from $12,000 to $12,500. SEP compensation limits of which you take that percentage, that goes from $260,000 to $265,000. The only bad news, John, was the Social Security tax base goes up this year to roughly $118,000. That's about a $1,500 increase. It goes up to $118,500. That's a $1,500 increase in the wage base, which you could pay either 15.3% tax on that, and also anything over the $118,500, you can pay 2.9 to 3.8, depending on which tax bracket you're in. That's the Obama Medicare tax plus the Medicare tax proposal. So a little bit of an increase on the Social Security wage base and Medicare tax base, but overall, most pension plans went up from $500 to $1,000, depending on your tax bracket, you could be saving up to 40 to 50% of that. Just take $1,000, and let's say your combined bracket is, let's say, 40%. You put that money away, you just saved an extra $400.
So the good news is that the limits were increased, which means, of course, more tax savings. But now the question comes, how do you know which plan to use? And this has sort of limitations on it, depending on where you're working. If for most investors, for example, if you're working for an employer, you may have no choice. It's whatever plan the employer happens to have. If you're working for a government or school system, things are limited there. It seems like the greatest flexibility would be for self-employed people. I mean, if I work for an employer with a 401k plan, that's probably my only option right there. So it would seem like most people, if they're not self-employed, are stuck with what they're offered at work.
Well, you're right about employees stuck with, let's say, an employer plan. I mean, if the employer plan has a 401k, you're probably stuck with the 401k. Now, there are other options out there. There's IRAs and Roth IRAs to medical savings plan. So there are a few more choices other than the employer plan. But then there are a whole other set of rules that get into limitations on whether you can use them or not. So, you know, once again, this is not made easy for the average person.
You know, at one point you start to think this is a little nutso because, again, it comes with a promise to do all sorts of good things with people. But if you look at the tax code, it's gotten much more complex. The rules are more complex. There are phase in, phase out, limitations. This gets to be overwhelming at times. Is this a help or a hindrance, you know? But in some cases, it may still be worth the effort because of the tax savings. They can be enormous, with major tax hikes coming under the late end of the Obama administration, wherever Congress may want to go with all of this, especially during silly season. But, you know, let's face it, the average person just doesn't have much choice.
Well, for most employees, I mean, they're basically limited to their employee plans, whether it's a 401k plan at a public company, private company in the private sector, 403B plans if you're a teacher, or 457 plans used in the government. But outside of those limitations, the only other factors that you have that could limit you is your income, because there are limits on IRAs if you do not have an employer pension plan. There are limits on IRAs if you do have an employer plan. And there are also limits on Roth IRAs. So once again, there's phase-ins and there's different rules depending on whether you have an employer plan or you don't have an employer plan. So once again, John, a lot more complication.
Now that we covered employees, contributions went up for employer plans. In addition to employer plans, there are IRAs. There's a Roth IRA, depending on your income. Let's move to the self-employed individuals. As I mentioned before, it seems like there's a lot more flexibility for people who are self-employed. They have a lot more options in addition to the popular 401ks and the traditional IRAs. Why don't you discuss some of the most popular pros and cons of each of these plans from a self-employed perspective?
You know, John, before I do that, I just want to cover some of the limitations on IRAs, because they are popular savings vehicles. If you are putting money into an IRA and you do not have a retirement plan, you know, they start to phase these out between $181,000 of income and $191,000 of income. If you are covered by a retirement plan, if you're single, they start to phase them out at $61,000 to $71,000. And if you're married, they start to phase these out at $98,000 to $118,000. So there's some limitations on there. Likewise, with the Roth IRA, you can put money in a Roth IRA. If you make $183,000, they phase them out if you make over $193,000. So for IRAs and Roth IRAs, depending on whether you're single or married, have an employer plan or don't have an employer plan, there's usually a $10,000 window where they begin to phase your contribution limits once you reach a certain level. Now, let's move on to what we call self-employed plans. And here you have a lot more choices, because much depends on the business. And the type of plan that you really want is, what kind of business do you have? Is it cyclical? Is it dependable? What kind of cash flow does your business generate? The number of employees you have? I mean, the best employer plan would be something that we call a defined benefit pension plan, because that would allow you to put away the maximum contribution fund for a $210,000 retirement benefit at retirement. So the drawback, it doesn't work if you got a lot of employees. This was what, John, most private sector companies, like the Fortune 500 companies, we use this in the 50s and 60s. And then when the government started changing the rules, they started making it complicated. We got inflation. What happened is, in the 80s, corporations moved away from defined benefit pension plans, where, you know, after a number of years of service, like working for the government, you could be assured that maybe you would get 80% of your salary when you retired for the rest of your life. Companies moved away from that to 401k programs, where basically whatever you got at retirement was whatever you put away and salted away. So defined benefit plans are still in place. There are companies that still use them, actually a couple Fortune 500 companies, although very few of them. But if you have a lot of employees, you have to contribute for them. And there's also, once you commit to a defined benefit plan, you can't change that, because, hey, we're in a recession, your profits go down, revenues go down, or you have a bad year in business. So defined benefit plans only work for companies that have few employees. They work for highly compensated individuals like consultants, athletes, movie stars. And it also helps the older you are, because the older you are, think about it, if you're funding for age 66 retirement or age 65 and you're 55, you've got fewer years to fund, which means you get to put more money away. So few employees, steady cash flow. And the older you are, these were defined benefit plans work very, very well. You know, we've set up a couple plans for individuals that are like that, either consultants, in one case, somebody in the entertainment industry, where they're putting away over $500,000 a year into these defined benefit plans. The only drawback is you have to fund that amount each year, no matter what's happening to you. So you need to have a steady, predictable cash flow in your business. And you can't just fund it in a year that you make a lot of money and say, hey, this year we had a real good year. I'll put money in my defined benefit plan. But the following year, it's not so good, and I'm not going to put money. It doesn't work that way. Once you commit, you have to do that because you could face stiff penalties from the IRS, and you don't want to get caught up in that kind of a situation. So you need to have predictable income. You have to be able to afford it. Has great benefits, but you know, we find it's only applicable in very special situations. Works best for solo individuals or companies with few employees or individuals who are not too far away from retirement. The closer you are to retirement and predictable cash flow, these can be great, great tax savings plans that can allow you to shelter and salt away, you know, especially as you get closer to retirement, a good portion of your income if you're fortunate enough to have the income to fund these kind of plans.
Sounds like defined benefits are the only special situations. What are the more workable options? I mean, plans with flexibility, but maybe greater contributions. We know that there are limits on the 401k, the 403b, 457, it's 18,000 a year plus 6,000 if you're over 50. So that maxes out at 23,000 a year. So what do you see as a more common plan? I mean, the most common plans, say, for example, that small businesses might want to use.
You know, for most businesses, we usually see combination plans in one form or another. It could be a defined contribution plan, profit sharing plan, where the limit is 53,000. So, you know, that's about 30,000 more than what you could put in a 401k or 403b or 457 plan. You've got SEP pension plans, simplified employee pension plans, $53,000. We've seen combinations of 401k plans with profit sharing plans. I have one client with a 401k plan plus a defined benefit plan, and he was able to do that. And it worked out very well because most of the employees, there are restrictions to get into these plans, but they were in their 20s, a few in their 30s. So, you know, there wasn't much. Obviously, if you're in your 20s, you've got 45 years away to fund for a retirement benefit. So there's less money that has to be put aside for those employees compared to an employer who's in his late 50s. So we have actually a couple of those. So, you know, the more employees, the further you are from full retirement benefits, the larger the benefits go to the owner, especially if the owner is closer to retirement, with, in this particular case, over 90% of the benefit was funding his retirement. But for the most part, John, for self-employed individuals, we're talking about combination plans like defined contributions, SEPs, or combo plans with profit sharing 401k plans. They offer the flexibility and a little bit more contributions than a simple 401k plan, which is limited at age 50 to about 23,000 or 18,000 today.
Now, here's where I get frustrated. How do you know? It's like picking out insurance plans for health insurance. How do you know which plans work best? I mean, there's so many different combinations, so many different rates and rules. At times it gets real complicated. You wish somebody could put it out in a chart. You know, with these, have you seen the charts, a little check mark? This is plan A, B, C, D, and then the different features on it. And then they check off what you get on both. And you go, oh, I can understand this. I'll pick that plan, you know?
Well, I mean, it's like anything else. Like anybody that's running a business, it's going to take time and a lot of planning and assessment because you have to take a look at the cash flow of the business. You don't want to put a plan in that could hurt the business should they come upon hard times. So you want to assess the cash flow of the business, the number of employees, because obviously the funding of those plans is going to come out of the profits of the business. You have to take a look at the owner's objective, the owner's age, and also careful consideration of government rules, because you don't want to get into the government has a set of rules. They call them top-heavy plans, where the government says, hey, look, we don't want the majority of the benefits of these plans mainly going to the owners, and the employees get hardly anything, because if you get into that situation, you could actually be fined and penalized. So you want to make sure you don't get into penalties or overfunding of plans. And it's the reason, you know, we have a stable of pension benefits, because almost every single year they're tweaking these plans in one form or another. You just don't have a simple answer. It starts with taking a look of a plan, the owner's objectives. What's the predictability of the business itself? Are you in a predictable service business where you can really gauge what profits are going to be? Are you in some kind of business where one year, you know, you could be making buku bucks and the next year, you know, you're running in the red. So you really have to take a look at and take some time, and then also use expert advice, because you want to make sure you dot the I's and cross the T's, because if you don't, there could be stiff penalties in overfunding where you get penalized, and you don't want to fall into that kind of trap.
So if we were to sum up here, contribution limits went up for 2015, anywhere from $500 to $1,000. So you're allowed to make greater contributions. This could mean anywhere from $200 to $400 extra in tax savings for this year. If you're self-employed, you have greater options, but the best thing you can do is take action. Start now, the first of the year, contributing to your plan. The sooner you start, the easier it is to save, and the more taxes you're going to save over the greater amount of time. You then have time on your side to accumulate assets for your retirement. But as it all begins with a plan, this is a nice segue into this week's case study, which we do every single week here on the program. The case studies are real, but the names have been changed. So, Jim, who do we have this week?
This week, we're going to call this the case of Mike and Carol Spencer. Mike, age 49, was an orthopedic surgeon. Carol, age 44, was a stay-at-home mom taking care of the three kids, but she's actually thinking of, she used to be a nurse at one time, that's how they met, and talking about going back into nursing, maybe part-time to maybe take care of some of the college costs. They had three kids, two girls, one son in college. The son was in college, and then the two girls were probably 4 years away from college. So, John, you could see the expenses mounting up here. Carol's thinking would be maybe she would work part-time and go back to aid in some of the college funding. They've been using and putting money aside in 529 plans with anywhere from $20,000 to $30,000 that were put aside to pay for these education plans. But the problem was, at this point in time, we had basically Mike was into his career, his gross earnings were up, and he was closer to $475,000 of income, which put him over the Obamacare tax brackets, which really pushed him up. He was losing itemized deductions. Well, he lost that at $250,000. And then at $450,000, he kicks into that extra Obama bracket. So now he's making enough money, and he's moving into those confiscatory Obama tax bracket, which begins at $450,000, which could take him up to 44% on the federal side, not to mention what he was paying here in the state of California. So the major tax increases result of experience. Now, in Mike's case, without doing certain things, he would be in a 44% tax bracket here for federal and 9.3% in California. In fact, once he was to grow over $500,000, he would jump to 10.3 in California. We also had, John, an issue here of funding with three kids, one in college, two shortly. So college costs were also a factor here. So if we were to come up with ways to save or put money aside for retirement, obviously, there's only so much money that they were saving, and that had to be allocated between college and also funding more for retirement.
Well, how did those two issues get resolved then? I mean, most parents, as good parents would, want to give their kids a sound education, which gives them a head start in life. And we know statistically that's true. The better the education you get, quite often you do better. Well, it's the issue many parents have just at the time when they need to save for retirement. They're hit with heavy college costs. I know a lot of cases I've heard you talk about mistakes. The parents make the mistake of going into debt or drawing down their bulk savings, which they need for retirement in order to pay for education, instead of saving for their own retirement.
As I mentioned, they were putting money aside in these 529 plans, and the money varied anywhere from $20,000 for the youngest to $30,000 to their son, who had already started into a junior college. But they didn't want to be heavily burdened, you know, as any parent didn't want their kids heavily burdened with student loans, which was one of the cases that Mike had going to medical school. You know, it took him more than a decade to pay off his student loans. And so he didn't want his kids to go through the same burden. And you're right, John, this is an issue that faces many parents. And fortunately, he made enough money to put some money aside in these 529 plans. Let's just hope that the president doesn't get his way and start taxing the earnings from these, because it's helping a lot of people.
So how do these issues get resolved then? Most parents, like we said before, want to give their kids a sound education to help them get ahead. How'd they pull these two things together?
I think the real key here was getting their views to change them on a college education. I mean, John, you go to a private college or out of state, you're looking at $150,000. You're talking about three kids. You're almost talking about $500,000 putting aside for college education. And they already had a son who wasn't quite sure what he wanted to do, was going to a junior college, and he was working. So I said, look, if we take and we fund for 2 years in a junior college, in 2 years in a state college, I mean, that's what I did. I had to pay my own education. I went to a junior college. God, you'll love this, John. I paid $45 a semester. So my two-year education cost me $180, not counting books. And then when I went to Arizona State, it cost me about $300. And when I graduated from Arizona State, it didn't say half a degree. It said Arizona State. I got my bachelor's degree. So, you know, we took a look at that in California here, a four-year degree, 2 years at a junior college, 2 years at a state college would run roughly about $50,000 per kid. So, you know, with the oldest kid, he already had close to $30,000. So instead of, you know, $150,000 per kid, $150,000 would cover roughly all three kids. And they're already more than halfway there with the 529 plan. So, you know, if the kids wanted to go, if one of them wanted to go to, let's say, a out-of-state school for a specialty or a private school, well, then they could get student loans. Or they could work or work online, which, you know, the son was already going to junior college and working because he wanted to pay for his car and other things that he want.
All right. Well, how do they handle that?
Well, you know, it was an easy decision to make because their oldest child, which was their son, was already in a junior college. And quite honestly, he wasn't sure what he wanted to do. He wasn't sure if he wanted to go into engineering or biochemistry. The girls really didn't have any definite plans at this time. So they agreed that the junior college and the state school greatly reduced the funding requirements, which would free up income for more retirement contributions, which is what we really needed to do here to get them below those confiscatory Obama tax rates.
You know, that's a problem that a lot of people have. You get too successful and then you get walloped with taxes, which actually acts as a lid. It's like, you know, they talk about a glass ceiling. It's a ceiling on weighting you against getting further ahead.
Well, I mean, fortunately, this was something he was already considering. It was really a question of funding because the medical group that he worked with would allow him to become an independent contractor, which is what we ended up doing. We recommended he go to an independent contractor status, and we set up a SEP, which allow him to contribute $52,000, which would knock him down below the confiscatory Obama tax rates. And this year, that number goes up to $53,000. So the result was we knocked him down into the Bush tax rates, and we were able to fund this because we were putting less aside for a college education. Once we made that change on, okay, there's a limit in terms of what we're going to put aside for a college education. And that's really something that most parents really have to decide. I mean, we all have financial goals. We want to do this. We want to do that. Sometimes you have to prioritize. In this case, we still had college funding covering a four-year degree at a junior college and a state university, but we also were taking care of dad's tax problem and also funding for both parents for their retirement.
So it seems that the change in college funding from $150,000 down to $50,000 per child was really the key that made it all work.
It was, because the change from what would have been an amount for each kid was reduced dramatically. I mean, instead of putting aside $150,000, multiply that times three, you're almost at $500,000. To $50,000, it was enough to cover a four-year degree with assuming 2 years at a junior college and a state school, which would leave their kids without any student loans. I mean, think of the head start their kids would have on life versus the average couple that brings $70,000 to $100,000 into a marriage today. It also freed up the extra $34,000 needed to fund the SEP plan of $52,000, which will be $53,000 this year. And it also reduced his tax savings. And you think about it, the tax savings alone were almost paying for John almost half of this. So here, as a result of that change, we were taking care of two goals: providing for college, at the same time, providing for retirement. And that was the compromise made here, but it was a compromise well worth it because it achieved both objectives.
Well, today we've been talking about retirement benefit plans, and coming up next, Rob Bernard, Executive Compensation Strategy as Lifetime Income continues at financialsense.com.
Last year, Congress raised income taxes, bringing the top tax rate to over 40%. For many individuals working in corporations, not only federal and state taxes can take up to 60% of an individual's income. So what do you do if you're a highly compensated employee? Well, a lot more companies are turning to various forms of compensation that can shelter or be tax deferred. Joining us on the program is Rob Bernard from PFS Group. And Rob, let's talk about what companies are doing to provide different forms of compensation, because we do know now, for example, if you live in California, the combination of federal and state taxes can take up to almost 60%. Of course, last year, everybody remembered the famous comments made by Phil Mickelson, the well-known golfer, where he said, I really have to start thinking about what I'm doing here, because 60% of what I make is being taken by either federal or state taxes. So let's talk about employers and what employers can do to, let's say, keep highly compensated employees, either at the executive level or even at the professional level, for example, PhDs doing research at, let's say, drug companies or biotech companies.
Well, Jim, ever since the dot-com days and sometime even before that, we had various compensation plans, one in particular, stock option plans and then stock plans. But the main reason that companies put these things together is to align interest of their employers with employees and make them have skin in the game and attract very much desired employees. And to do this, they have, as I said, stock option plans. There's two types, incentive stock plans, which are called ISOs, and that's best for long-term capital gains because an employee can exercise the options, hold the options for a year and a day, and then sell them and receive long-term capital gains. Those are the best for employees. Once again, those are called incentive stock options. And there are ways to hedge while you are waiting for that year and a day to get your long-term capital gains. The most common ones are called non-qualified stock options. They are ordinary income to employees, and employers expense them as salary. They also have vesting schedules, as well as the incentive plans, and they also have sunsetting provisions. Now, what that means is that a vesting schedule, for example, is that you may be granted options, but they're vested a year at a time to keep the employee's interests still aligned and keep them focused. Sunset means that they have a time when they expire, so that these employees have to keep their eye on the ball to make sure they exercise those options before they expire.
Usually when they're vesting, is there any laws that govern that vesting schedule? In other words, is there a defined period, 4 years, 5 years? I mean, obviously they can't go on forever.
Most of these plans, they can go 5 years out, but it's really to the discretion of management on how they want to structure these plans.
All right. So we talked about a qualified plan, a non-qualified plan. Let me ask you this. In a non-qualified plan, Rob, when it's structured sort of like a salary, does the employee pay taxes on that?
Yes, these options are taxable the moment they're exercised. So the HR department usually has a formulation to levy the FICO, levy the state, levy the federal, all the little taxes that go into there so that the client gets a net check after it's all said and done.
Now, what about, are there any other plans other than non-qualified? In other words, are there variations and things that go with these different plans?
Well, the variation is actually stock plans. I mean, we talked about what happens with option plans, and then you have stock plans, and there are various different formats. For example, we have RSUs, which stands for Registered Stock Units. They're granted as well. They have vesting schedules, but when they are due, they must be sold and taxes are levied that day. So you don't have quite the flexibility as the option plans. If your stock vests on June 1st, it is sold on June 1st. You can contact your HR department and say, look, I just want to sell the amount of shares to pay my taxes and then issue me or send those shares to my brokerage and I start my new cost basis over again. And then you have what's called phantom stock plans, and these are for non-public corporations. So let's just see that they want to attract a highly qualified individual, such as a CEO or CFO. They will grant him phantom shares of stock. The calculation for the value comes from book value and earnings per share multiple. And it's up to management or the board of directors to decide when the executive can monetize his stock. Also, we have employee stock purchase plans, which a lot of employees can participate in. Usually it happens on a quarterly basis. The shares of stock can be purchased at deep discounts, anywhere from 10 to 15% discounts, and they can be subject to earned income tax rates or long-term capital gains rates, depending upon when they're sold.
Let me ask you a couple things regarding stock options. Let's say I'm granted stock options. There's a vesting schedule. Let's say I want to hold it for a year for long-term capital gains. But let's suppose, Rob, we're in 1999. Things are getting real frothy. Stocks are going up. And you're an executive saying, you know what? I don't know how much longer this can last. What can I do to protect those gains if I have to wait for, let's say, either a vesting schedule to exercise those options, or number two, I have to hold them for a year to get long-term capital gains benefits?
Well, there you'd be talking about your ISO options or your non-qualifieds that you've already exercised, paid the tax, and now you've started a new capital gains holding period. What you can do, it's called zero-cost collars. These are sophisticated options that are custom-tailored to your needs so that you can hedge your stock via a ladder form, like we ladder bond portfolios, or you can just hedge the entire thing. And what that means is that you're going to get a custom guy that's, you're going to sell calls, take the proceeds from the calls, and buy a put, and you're going to have a spread maybe of 10 points. And each tranche of stock that you would prefer to do that on, you can ladder up or ladder down. Now, the interesting thing about that is that you can extract 85% of the equity in that hedge position. And these hedge positions could last as long as 36 months. It all depends on what you want to accomplish. These are all custom-tailored plans, usually done by a lot of brokerage firms can do them. We can actually do them here as well. But that's how people maintain and hedge themselves for volatile market conditions.
Let me throw out another scenario. You have some options. Maybe you haven't held them for a year. You have some option units, or you have whatever class of options have been granted to you. But let's say you haven't held them a year. They're not fully vested. All of a sudden, the public company you work for is bought out. What happens to those options? How are they treated? And are they immediately exercisable? In other words, immediately vested when somebody takes a company over?
Yes, what you're talking about there is change of control. So if a publicly traded company is taken out by another publicly traded company, all of those options, whether or not they're ISOs or non-qualified, as well as registered stock units, RSUs, or employee stock purchase plans, all become vested immediately. So it's a huge monetization for all employees that are participating in one form or another of compensation here. So what happens is that on the day that the deal closes, all the vesting schedules are basically zero. So that means that all options are exercisable. All your RSUs now fund and monetize. Taxes are owed on that day. It's very busy for the HR department in formulating all these tax bills that go directly to the IRS, of course, in the state of California or whatever your state of residence is. So to your question, everybody gets monetized at the date of closing.
Let me throw something out. In some of these mergers that we've seen taken out, let's say you're granted some options. They're in the money, but you're holding them. You're waiting for long-term capital gain. And let's say you're a highly compensated employee, Rob, where you're, you know, let's say a top-level executive, and all of a sudden your company gets bought out. You know, you're talking about many of these cases we've seen where all of a sudden you become a multi-millionaire. It seems like that would require a lot of planning because your financial situation has changed substantially, not only from, well, number one, you're being bought out, your net worth increases, you don't know if you're going to stay on with the new company that comes in, so you may have issues of how do I live off this income, am I going to continue working someplace else or at the company, and also there's all kinds of estate tax issues that can come into play, especially when you're talking about substantial gains. I mean, we can all think back of what happened to a lot of these takeoffs during the dot-com boom, where people were instant millionaires with their stock options, and then they were taken out.
That's correct. It's been my experience that once the individual has satisfied the tax liability, they then begin to do some estate planning, and then they realize that they've just hit the monetization lotto. And the most important thing is not to try to make home runs, but just make small base hits and just eke, you know, ahead of inflation and not lose your money by taking excessive risks. One account may be set up for a little more aggressive investing, but the main body of their money is usually in tax-exempt municipal bonds and some very low volatility type of stocks, blue chips for that matter. Once again, they just don't want to take excessive risk and lose a lot of money. They'd just be happy to enjoy that tax-exempt income and rising dividend payments from some high blue chip stock types.
Do a lot of these companies have like financial planning, or would you recommend somebody, like let's say if you're a highly compensated employee and all of a sudden either number one, you're exercising substantial options, number two, your company is being bought out, or let's say number three, you're worried about your options that are in the money and worried about the condition of the market, or let's say your stock has had a huge run-up and you want to protect those gains. It seems to me like a lot of planning would be warranted.
Well, here's one thing that highly compensated executives can do, especially the ones that are involved in non-public information. There's plans called preset diversification plans so that they can predetermine how many shares they want to sell, whether it be monthly, quarterly, weekly. They put that plan into place. There's a cooling off period of about 2 weeks, and then the plan's in force. And it doesn't make any difference if they have material information that's non-public when the date of sale happens. That way they can constantly be diversifying themselves of their highly concentrated stock positions, whether it's options or stock. A lot of my past and current clients that have options, they actually set these plans in force for their option exercises. So every quarter, they go ahead and exercise a certain amount of options to, once again, diversify highly concentrated positions. And then once we gather that money, then it goes into tax-exempt bonds or other types of blue-chip type stocks, where then we are in that diversification mode.
Rob, over the years, you've seen a lot of this go on. What would you say is the most important thing that you have learned in dealing in this area? And what are some of the biggest mistakes that you've seen execs make?
Well, the biggest mistake that I've seen executives make was in the dot-com days. A lot of executives got so excited about their own companies, they had a tough time, you know, coming back to earth and reality. So when they wanted monetization, they didn't necessarily liquidate their portfolio or their company stock. They margined against it, extracted monies, and then went out and bought their boats and Ferraris and so on and so forth. I was personally rooting for zero-cost collars because you could hedge your entire stock position. You could extract 85% of the equity in that hedge position. And if the stock market or your company fell into hard times or we had the crash of the dot-com, you were completely protected. Whereas these guys that took their money out on a margin aspect of it, they had huge margin calls. And then, of course, the margin calls produced selling, and the selling produced more selling. And then, of course, the IRS is there with its handout saying, you boys, you sold all this, now pay up. So a lot of executives back then loaded up, bought their big boats and houses and Ferraris and such, and then all of a sudden at the end of 2000-2001, they had fire sales to pay the tax bill because they had to liquidate at bargain basement prices. So interestingly enough, my biggest takeaway from the dot-com days is guys did not want to hedge with zero-cost collars. They extracted their money out of their accounts via margin, and it was a disaster for a lot of dot-com guys, all the way from, you know, Silicon Valley all the way down to Orange County and in some cases in San Diego.
You know, it seems like people get enthused, and especially when you go through a mania, as we saw there in the latter part of the 90s with technology. And certainly we've seen that in various sectors where you get caught up and you seem to think that your industry is going to continue to go up in that way. It sounds like to me a little cautious planning or a little hedging would pay off in the long run.
Yes, exactly. Especially with the part that you can ladder your hedges. If you think your stock's got more upside potential, great. You know, have 10,000 share tranches or 20,000 share tranches from, you know, $20 to 25 to 30 to 35, but protect the downside of it. It's so simple to do, and yet a lot of people feel that they're going to give away too much upside potential, and they're not necessarily worried about the downside.
You know what I think happens, and especially a lot of these startup companies, whether it's biotechnology or the latest tech company, what happens, I think, Rob, is people get caught up, and especially in the smaller companies, if there's a movement where the big companies start buying the little guys, a lot of these smaller companies don't have the HR department, so they really, you know, they're granting options to maintain, and a lot of times in these startup companies where they're not getting, let's say, the salary of a large company, so they're getting compensated in stock as a reward. It seems like it would behoove company management to have some kind of planning or counseling for these executives because, you know, a lot of times when you get caught up in a movement in the market where the big companies all of a sudden decide, you know, we're going to grow by buying other companies, and then all of a sudden these small companies get gobbled up, and all of a sudden your whole financial situation changes suddenly overnight.
Yes, and what we see now happening is a lot of the HR departments are going out and seeking small boutiques such as us and asking for help for their executives. So the executives have a place to turn for trust planning, for preset diversification plans, and not only that, but to facilitate deferred compensation plans. Now, you know, if you get a big bonus at the end of the year, what do you do with it? Some people don't want it. They don't want to pay the extra tax on it. Well, you have a non-qualified deferred compensation package where you can put money away. It's not taxed. And when you do need it, you can pull it out and then pay taxes on it. These are all types of things that these HR people are able to go out and scour and find little boutiques that can handle these types of executive situations and not overburden the executive and the HR department with questions and such.
Well, listen, Rob, as we close here, if our listeners are, let's say, somebody in HR or maybe you're a highly compensated executive, would like to talk to you about, let's say, either collaring their options or setting up a preset plan, how can they do so, please?
Thanks, Jim. They can contact me at 888-486-3939, extension 118. I'd be happy to talk to them about their own personal situations.
Well, that concludes this week's Lifetime Income. Once again, folks, you know, this is the New Year's time you're making New Year's resolutions. Really sit down with your planner, your financial advisor, get into financial shape this year, start saving for retirement. The government's going to subsidize it. We talked about this week's program, how those limits have gone up so you can put more money aside. Maybe save a few more bucks for taxes. And in this case study, hopefully we gave you some ideas on college funding if you're dealing with both those issues to make it more reachable. But do something. Don't procrastinate. Start a plan. This is the beginning of the year. The more money you put aside, the earlier you do it, the longer you do it, the more you're going to have for those retirement years. Well, we've run out of time as we always do during this hour. On behalf of John Leffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.